Well, I don't other things but really this philosophy also mystical in Islam rules is only a policy in speaking what was it called that? Before we go on, we have, as I said, even now a no participant. Great. But we have our auditor, I think there, PhD, and I think the PBO guy there, and I don't know if they can play. What we're asking for, to facilitate tomorrow's witnessing with the Pope, if it's possible, within the limitation of time, is to draw on the submissions we've got. They haven't written for many cases. Don't mind what people say tomorrow, we love me and elaborate on what they've got in addition to what they've got in writing. You know, can we have a table to say, for example, we look at the auditing book, that's the main book tomorrow. On the auditing book, how many commissions we've got? Well, just one, it's easy, you don't have to put a table. But on the bank book, we've got several, right? So give you more time. So what you do is, on the submissions they've made, say back to the mentor 14.1a, you will say, 14.1a, what the proposal is in a nutshell, and then which organization. So if four organizations want to change one particular cause, we give it more weight than it's just one gun. You know, so we need a table then for the other two votes. Alright? Bridget, for now, can you take major responsibility for that?
They've done a thing already.
Oh, you normally do the same. And this is a procedure in this committee here. We ask the executives to do a summary for Parliament on a bill that Parliament is supposed to be. Okay, that I was saying. But this is how the committee is doing it. Because the executive do the summary. Yeah, I mean, this is part of the official, not Parliament. Yeah, it's ours. Because the other thing you would skew things. But it's wrong. It's not your job. It has been skewed. In my entire experience in local government, it's always skewed. So we ask the department to do one, and we did this one, and you see substantial difference. So we must, it's the nature of things. In other words, ask your chair, I would do the same. And if you were one with my chair, you'd say, hey, how can you be wrong? So we will look at this, right? And then, you know, do our own and see, you know, what we can actually do is where we find more amendments than our reflection, and that's the trick, what we can add to that, okay? But we have to go on reading and our own study. Okay. Anything else you want to say before we go on? No? Okay. Right. Over to you.
So, the bank and mentor. So, we see here that it's a very, very thick girl that you have, about 2 pages. And the reason for it, but don't be deceived. The 2 pages are going to generate a lot of heat to the point that there'll be swarms and swarms of lawyers who are going to come, which means that I'll come to the end. I'm not sure if we can rush the floor as quickly as you anticipate, just given the issues that will arise. So, I think what you're doing is just basic things. So, you know, look at the simple amendment. Normally you think within 5 minutes you get the sense of this matter, if it's not controversial, and that's it. So mostly while we hear that these are urgent amendments to the Banks Act, and basically they increase option for the curator who's been appointed to resolve a banking problem. Or banks is not able to meet its obligations. And it's certain people would like to extend this option to the creatorship of African Bank. And I want to take care, we're going to studiously not talk about African Bank. Because that's in the hands of the creator, and the creator needs to be left to do his for her work, and certainly we need to protect the curator while they're doing this work. It's not a nice business. They need to protect their sort of independence once they do their job. There's a role for the curator, there's a role for the minister, there's a role for the governor, and it's quite important that everyone plays their respective role. Of course, once they finish their job, we will hold them to be accountable and get them to the necessary reporting. So, and let me say that in the two-seat system, and we had a presentation on the reforms that we have, that we will be introducing more modern legislation to resolve how you deal not just with trading banks, but trading insurance, trading financial institutions. But obviously, this comes to Roy, then we'll be having a resolution. It'll be more like, yeah, we'll have, might have a draft at the end of this year, but the next year issue. At some point, we have to have a resolution. We'll be working on a dedicated resolution for financial institutions. And this is in line with what the practices are internationally. It's a very complex topic, but we're not there yet. So this is just an incremental change that we're introducing. It goes along the way in which the major reforms will be, because what this provides for is allows the bank to be split into what we call the good bank and the bad bank. And basically, in this, Dr. Roy Haberman and Andrew Francisco, my colleagues here, and I know some colleagues from the Reserve Bank will be joining us. So basically, if this option is not available, what effectively happens is that the creator has to operate under the current dispensation. And as you will see in the submission, the creator believes that they're going to have to opt for liquidation. So the way the model is the company is actually there and the normal liquidation proceeds. But for banks, you don't quite get there. You have relationships before that. But the sort of normal liquidation is also an option that the creator has. And the creator feels that he would have to do this in this case if this option is not available. And of course, that means not just that the creditors lose, I should say that those people who had shares, for example, in African Bank got wiped out in August. But in addition, creditors will lose out, and then the employees and then what, about 5,000 plus will lose their jobs, and so on. Okay. So the intention is, when we introduce this, is to really ensure that no creditor was off. Than what they would have been had they been in liquidation. And I'm more about that later. So, Chair, what I want to say though, is that this bill will meet some significant resistance, mainly from, I guess, creditors who are losing out, because the creditors get, some people are taking, senior creditors take a haircut sales of 10%, so they get 90%. That means that, they still lose 10%. People want to still get 200%. Some get wiped out to 0% possibly, so they obviously want to make sure that they increase their share. And I think it's important just to keep this in mind. So this is why we're here. Move on. I think, the lesson internationally, hardly any significant country that I'm aware of, in fact no significant economy, would allow just normal liquidation for their banks, for very good reasons. And you've seen the crisis in 2008, particularly in the US, Japan, Korea, Mexico, Germany, all these countries, and most recently Portugal, have had to deal with banking problems, and these have did the taxpayers end up paying, just because in December when you took off to speak, most banks are regarded as simply or systemically important financial institutions. And if you look at the cost of this, the taxpayers range from 13% in Finland to 32% in Turkey in 1 year. So the key lesson is that, banks crashes are very painful. Lots of people lose real money. And any intervention plan involves transfer of wealth from creditors to debtors effectively. And hence, it's going to be always contested. And certainly, to the extent that you have a problem, the sooner you act, the sooner, the more likely you solve. If you just follow the Euro crisis currently, you'll see that there's huge expression. You keep on kicking the can down the road. What you're going to find that even though the upfront costs seem high at the time, if you don't act, the cost that you end up paying ultimately will be huge. And I think if you look at the Euro crisis, the components in which they dealt with their banks, you can see just how expensive it becomes for the Euro area. So even to this day, you're not sure what's going to happen. So what do you expect, and so, you know, I think on how the flow may affect current stakeholders. Okay? So the key stakeholders that we have here, obviously are sponsors, and then what Paul will explain in more detail, senior and subordinated creditors. Okay? People who have lend money to the bank, and there's an order of preference. If you're a senior creditor, you sort of have first preference in the event that the bank is wound down, and the subordinated who tend to be last in the queue, but for taking great risk, they obviously expect greater reward and tend to get paid out more as well. And then, of course, there's the shareholders. As you know, depositors are implicitly protected. We don't have legislation, but retail depositors have tended to be protected in South Africa up to a certain amount, but investors are not. In this instance, you don't just have legal depositors for the ones protected, but corporate depositors are also being protected in this instance of African practice that we've seen. And fund managers have certainly lost money and have to act in interest of their funds. And I'm raising this because I think you may, just to ensure that when you look at these submissions, you don't get confused. Because you find that one company may have four different submissions. And that's certainly because it's within the company and the holding company. You know, your parent or your major your holding company may be a bank. In some cases, through their insurance. But then you find that, and then it's sort of a subsidiary, which is an asset management subsidiary. Okay. And even within the subsidiary, the asset management company, you find that there's different fund managers. There's fund managers who do senior debt, there's fund managers who do subordinated debt. Okay. Every fund manager is going to act in the interest of their fund. So they have a legal responsibility when they can't hear what the CEO is saying. The asset management company, they're going to ask for their fund. Okay. So the same asset management company will have two or three different fund perspectives, and each of them will want to take legal action. In addition, their bank may also come in. So what you'll find is across one group, and in fact you have it, you find one group that's winning four submissions. Okay. So don't expect the company position. Each fund or each player has a different spot to protect. Even though, for example, three of their pots may benefit, the one pot that doesn't benefit is going to try and, you know, obviously exist because it's trying to maximize or minimize its own losses and hope the other guys take less. And in a sense, if you listen to them and we liquidate, all four pots may lose out very significantly. So I wouldn't want to be in that building and have four maybe groups there. But we should bear in mind, you know, the real victims are not necessarily the fund managers. Yes, their reputations are affected, their bonuses may not be very high, although banks and so on you find people get bonuses when they fail, which is a problem in the pension structure. But clearly, potentially the losers could be deposited. Taxpayers could be losers if the government has to bail out the institution. And you only bail out banks because they are filthy, they are not like any other company. The employees of this person of the institution will lose out. you know, perhaps those people who have borrowed money lose out in the sense that they may not get better terms than they had before. The banking system as a whole gets affected, small banks, and in fact the instance of African banks, I think the surprise for us was, what is not one of the larger banks? It certainly proved that it was a city when you looked at the impact of money market funding. Okay. Of course, creditors of the banks, the funds are affected, but underlying that, the pension funds that they are investing for themselves. And of course, one needs to look at what was the responsibility of trustees, understand the risk that fund managers are taking. So, Chair, I think what is called is this very good thing to provide the background translations. And we're doing this because you see that some of the conditions, given context, the notion of curatorship and say you should just wind back down through the company there. So for them it's not just the way they argue that it's unconstitutional. Not just these provisions, but logically it means the entire Bank Act has been unconstitutional the last 20 years. Okay. We of course don't agree with that view. But the point is they are betting, because I believe that they've lost power. They obviously don't understand the risk. And in fact, the biggest question for people who invested their funds into the fund, if they didn't understand the risk after 2008, it means they weren't really newspapers. Okay. Even ordinary people know there was a global financial crisis and what the risks are. Because many of the losses, for example, for World War investments, World War loans made after 2008, but others will come to those moments. Why do you want to go to the test? I just had my start, so I'm hoping not to go to the process. But you will see, we're not unique. Okay? I know this seems like a special factor. If you've got a problem, you're now trying to educate for that. You'll see that, unfortunately, with banking crises, sometimes it's only when it happens that you realize the extent to which you need to be legally right, and you have to make amendments, okay? And how all these jurisdictions, okay, have had to change their legislation and deal with the current crisis, which in a sense was created because of policies that were made.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but just to highlight the most interesting one, obviously the United Kingdom Banking Special Provisions Act, and actually one of the advisors who was on the drafting team for the advisory act in the committee process, they had to go through quite a complex bill very quickly, and that we had to recall Parliament to put it through. And then the Icelandic Act is very interesting in the context of the GSR, of the financial system in Iceland, and it was a huge emergency for Iceland, and as you know, they actually had to implement substantial financial controls as part of it to ensure the safety of their country running. And then the US, the most interesting one, is obviously incredibly long legislation called the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010, which provides for a huge number of areas of new financial regulation, many of which we have been implementing over the last few years in each of the legislation we brought to this committee, like the Financial Markets Act, and the Trading Services Act, and which will also be included in the forthcoming financial regulation law. Another really interesting one was the German Act of 2011, which also amended a number of different existing statutes, even though Germany didn't have those very large banking crisis. We were very fortunate here, and I think it's a test to the strength of the South African system of legislation, that we only had to make very small amendments to our Bank Act to deal with what is a very small duration in context of other jurisdictions. And I think we can use those. Then I think just to highlight, just to talk about a moment, is why banks are treated differently than other countries in terms of insolvency. So any bank that's in trouble, or even seeks in trouble, obviously is subject to a bank run. And it's very important that the bank is built on public trust and confidence. Bagehot wrote a book in the late 1800s said that when a banker has to defend why his credit is good, then he has lost the confidence of the market. The moment the banker actually has to defend himself, then he's lost confidence, then the market has lost confidence in him. And there's been an enormous number of different bank failures, as you know, over the last few years. And it emerged out of that moment that the concept of a systemically important financial institution in FTSE. That is an institution which has links to the rest of the financial system in any particular way, and if the failure of this financial institution fails, then it can have enormous ripple effects. Bear Stearns is a very interesting example. It was by no means the largest investment bank in the US in 2007, I think it was 10th or something. It had enormous effects on the US banking system and went into difficulty. We've had our own set of bank failures over the years. We were very fortunate, the last significant one was about 12 years ago, and we are having African bank failures now, so we expect the next one to be another 12 years, we hope. We've had very well established system of curatorship. There's successfully investment banks and other banks that always allow them to be wound down. So just to highlight here, there are two different parts of the bank act that deal with the winding up of a bank. The first section is section 68, which is essentially the same as the liquidation procedures in the Companies Act. But because a bank is a slightly different type of company, section 68 provides for essentially liquidation of banks. Section 69 provides for what we call curatorship, which is basically to allow a bank to be saved and or to provide a mechanism for a very managed process when a bank goes into difficulty. Curatorship is a very long process. I mean, we only started with African bank curatorship in August of last year, and we've only been at it for a few months now. The Congo curatorship sort of was finalized during the course of last year. So the curatorship can take anywhere between 10 and 15 years, and that's just because they're very, very complex. I can't tell you how many people we have in the curatorship.
Just to make a point, I was once reading this from Demons. They say the lawyers who will wind up Demons in the U.S. are yet to be born. So these things are full of lawyers. So they have thousands of vehicles. Each fund has lawyers getting them to come to agreement, if you can just imagine.
Okay. Yeah, I think we found about 25 lawyers on this particular thing. You'll be working on them tomorrow. So then this really goes into the post-2008 Global Financial International Development. So there's a new concept, well, not really new, but there's a new set of words called recovery and resolution, which is essentially the proposed approach from G20 to highlight how do we go about resolving institutions that are in distress. In our law, essentially these are covered by the two sections of the Bank Act, section 68 and section 69. But that said, the Bank Act doesn't cover everything that the G20 has proposed, and that's not surprising, considering that the last major document on the issue was actually only put out last year. And we have circulated for the committee a copy of the key attributes of effective resolution regime.
This is something good, okay? The document must be there. If you go into the financial stability board site, and you can certainly make available by email the more detailed document. So you just see what the global approach towards effective resolution.
And this is summarized with key attributes. For us, there's one very, very important key attribute, and that is that in the resolution of any bank or any large financial institution, it is as far as possible not to rely on public solvency support. And that's a very important principle. What it's basically saying is the taxpayer should not be held responsible when a bank goes into stress. And that does mean that the losses for a bank that is in distress, or a bank that is in curatorship in our law, must be allocated to the people that own the bank, the shareholders, and the unsecured and uninsured creditors in their order of seniority. So we'll get into the order of seniority later. And then there's some other key attributes. The most interesting one is to ensure the continuity of systemically important financial services. So you'll find if a large bank goes into distress, one of the issues that arises is obviously that it provides more services to the rest of the economy, and you need to have a system of ways that you can keep those things going. And then the last one is can exit the market in an orderly way and not create too much stress. So these are some of the key attributes that are guiding the drafting of our big resolution book, but have also definitely guided some of the small amendments we put forward today. Then just to go through how we have responded to the global financial crisis. Most importantly, as we reached the committee on the end of last year, is the shift of the regulatory system towards transparency. Now, one of the most interesting things that happened during the global financial crisis is the systemic importance of a company called AIG, which was actually an insurer, the American Insurance Group. And it fell shortly after Lehman, and this made people realize that insurance companies also bring risks to financial stability and also need to be regulated in a way that's consistent with how we regulate banks. So that really gives some of the context for our idea, which is to shift the supervision of insurance companies into the same institution that is supervising the supervision of banks. That will be called an essential authority, and it will be a reserve bank. And I think we went through quite a detail on the financial sector regulation for last year. But we have also published at the end of last year, and we're actually doing a public workshop today, on the second draft of the financial sector regulation board, which we've got a lot of information on. And then also together that statistics can know the published draft market conduct policy framework, which kind of puts out the principles for how we're going to look after how banks interact with each other. And then we've spoken about the new resolution. Then we had a statement by the IMF during the course of last year on our resolution team and our whole financial system, and we have circulated a copy of the summary of that for even reading. They are very clear that we're going to update our resolution regime. We strongly support this proposal. We have actually been drafting for quite a while. They highlight that the current situation, however, lacks some critical features which may bring about additional taxpayer risk and could have problems for how the system functions. And they really highlight the resolution powers, so legal powers should be available in earlier junction. What they're trying to say here is that we should be able to act quicker and sooner when we see the distress of bank development. And we are currently just preparing a bill which we'll bring forward, I think, probably by early next year.
Okay, so this is the FSS report. And again, it's just a summary. And we would love to email the entire report to publish. We're putting our website in December, the IMF publishes the article report. It goes into gory detail on the state of the financial sector. It has stress-tested our banks. It has said that while our financial institutions, many banks are sound, because that's why it says the interconnectedness is a problem. And in fact, look at the case of, therefore, an African bank of Turkey. Because just how even small bank is connected to every other bank or other fund, and a small problem can actually cause that this entire system. So I would really recommend this reading if one is just understand the financial sector and the independent assessment on the financial system.
To build on the point, so this is a diagram which is difficult to understand, and that's the point of the diagram, which shows how the South African financial system is interconnected. And all that means is that we need to have a regulatory system that can deal with the substantial interconnectedness and complexity. And that the sort of proposed amendment to our law that we bring forward is to ensure that we can deal with this complexity. As you are going to be very stable over the quite a number of years during a number of these crises. So we are aware of this and intend to deal with it as quickly as we can. But we are not to be complacent.
Also why I think if you're just supervising a bank, but you need to ensure that you're linked to pension funds. Hence I think the approach you take across, you know, to say if you're doing prudential, you must do prudential for every
Yeah, that's very important in terms of thinking about, for example, how money market funds invest its money. It has quite big implications because of the way that money market funds invest the bank for the bank itself. So you have to be very careful about how all these things overlap. So we have huge work streams going on, and we have new proposals all the time. So these are just some of the things that we'll be to explain some things that we'll be bringing forward in the resolution bill, but just to explain the different contexts. So this most interesting concept is this new idea of bail-in. What bail-in means is that the creditors must take what we call a haircut on what they've lent to the bank. And that's actually the basis of the creditors, because what you would do in a normal situation is you would just liquidate the bank, and the creditors would just get whatever is left. So, I mean, the bank has liquidation rights, we just sell the assets for the best price and get it, and the assets are sold very quickly, and so it can create those disruptions. In Belgium, what that is a bit like a creditor's compromise. What it says is that the creditors will take the same amount, but the transfer of the bank will continue to be able to function. And that's essentially what we've done in the African bank situation. So although creditors take a small loss, and most of them are, have realized that they've actually, that we've been quite generous in the redemption that we've offered them, because there has been some additional money from the Reserve Bank. So that provides for a mechanism for the bank to continue functioning. Now there are other options, for example, like a bridge bank. The complete other example is some countries have nationalized their banks, but that's only really to quite desperate, I think, and you need to take the thing out of the system. And then the very other extreme is outright liquidation, so you just let the thing go. So that brings us to the proposed amendment to the law. As we said, there are only 2 pages long. We have prepared a track change version to help the committee, which just puts in the amendment into the law where here. So it's quite helpful because to allow the committee to read the whole QH section so that you can see the amendment in context. And that's quite important. And I particularly want to highlight section 69.1a of the law, which we obviously are not amending. But it's a very important section in terms of explaining why we do this, so why we go into creditorship. And it says that if in the penal register any bank will be unable to repay when legally obliged to do so, deposits may be or probably unable to meet any of its obligations, the minister may place the bank into creditorship. And then it's typically to protect the depositors, or in the case of insurance, the policyholders, and to protect the financial system from disruption. And it goes into quite a lot of detail, and it's very good in terms of giving checks and balances to the curator. So it explains what the curator is allowed to do, what he's not allowed to do, when he must do it, when he must not do it, etc., etc. And like Norma said, we have been through a number of curators. We've had hundreds of legal opinions on curators in the past. We've had some major court cases, many of which we can send you. And this section 69 has survived quite well through at least 4 different curators under the new constitution. Number one, the first time for constitution. And so the amendments are really just to assist the curator at the moment. So the law though is a little bit vague on a certain point. Section 69.2b says that the registrar, or rather the curator, must act in the best interest of the creditors or best promote the interest of the creditors. And that's very important. He is appointed by the minister to deal with the curatorship on behalf of the creditors. And what we have proposed is some more wording to guide the curator to allow him to understand what the interest of the creditors, what that means. And I'll explain that when we go into the law that's done now. And then technically, the law is very interesting. It says at the moment that the curator can dispose of any of the bank assets. What that basically means, and this has been found to be constitutional, in at least definitely in Tambo and in Regal, the curator can dispose of any of the bank assets in the ordinary course of business. It doesn't say anything about the liabilities of the bank. So technically, the curator can sell almost all the assets of the bank in a very straightforward procedure, but that doesn't mean anything about people that the bank owes money to. And what we would like to do is create a new bank where we should think across both the assets and the liabilities. To a new entity, and that is definitely in the best interest of everybody, and it's most importantly in the best interest of the financial system, to create a new good bank that will function better. And we are making an addition to that section, which I'll explain in a moment. So, essentially, the big proposal is to go through that thing that I circulated, the track change version. You look at the second page, section 692CA, we are adding transfer of any of its liabilities, and we are adding disposal of any of its assets and transfers to any of its liabilities. So we are providing for the curator to be able to follow a procedure to be able to move things across to a new entity, and to ensure the new entity functions quite well. But very important to the conscious data, we need to ensure that there are appropriate checks and balances in the law to ensure that the director can be guided by the law in terms of how he exercises these powers. And so there's quite a long session here in terms of what he needs to do in order to be able to do this. And we have taken at least advice from three different team councils, all of whom surprisingly enough agreed on the point, so it's quite convenient. And they feel very strongly that it's very important that the curator and the minister need to follow the promotion of the Ministry of Justice Act in the process of transferring both assets and liabilities. So there's a very important concept in our law, obviously, which is that creditors have the right to be heard. And so in both cases, the curator needs to follow due process in preparing a report, which he essentially is advising the minister and curator what he thinks the best procedure is for the curation of the bank. And he needs to follow due process and consider the creditors and listen to what the creditors want in the process of preparing the report. Secondly, when the minister considers the report and when the minister applies his mind to the report, he needs to also follow the due process before it comes to conclusion. So that is contained in the proposal section 2C, small c, where it says, in seeking consent or disposal of assets or transfer of liabilities for such disposal and functions in the paragraph B, the curator shall report to the minister and registrar as the KMB on the expected effect on the creditors and whether they treat equitably or whether or not they'll be better off than if they had been wound up under 58. So this 2C, so 2big C, little B, small Roman 2, is a very important principle that comes out of the attributes. What it says is that you need to think very carefully what would the position of the creditors have been in the event of liquidating the bank under section 68, and you must ensure as far as possible that the creditors come off better off than they have done if we had simply followed liquidation. And the key attribute is very strong on this, and I think all the international winding up of banks has been very strong on this point, is that this is a very important principle, which is what you're really trying to do is you're trying to ensure that the creditors come up better than they would have been if we just put the bank into liquidation. And that's quite an important principle. Some people will argue that they should come out much, much quicker than we think they should. Essentially what it means is that we would have to put more money into the bank from the reserve bank. That's considerable. So you have to find a balance between what the curator's profession and the creditor's interest.
Yes,
it's
principle
is
there
that
well, but if anyone is really unhappy, they will still try and exercise their legal rights and so on, and that's why it could take even longer. And that's why at some point it becomes, you know, a process where you have to, like Roy said, make sure that everybody understands that you're not going to get 100%. That in fact you liquidate it. You know, you would be lucky if you only got 20 or 30% of what you had. But once you're there, people are trying to push to see can they move it from 10% to 20% or 30% to 50%. And the greatest job is quite a tough job. And at the end of the day, kind of there's a balance and almost everybody agrees that you're not happy. You're sort of equally unhappy given our legal rights and therefore they won't pursue their legal, well, the rights that they think they have.
Yeah,
so it's not a very clear process in one sense.
In the current period, it's taken from August to the 10th of December for the curator to get to the point where he fully understood what the financial position was of this institution. Which is not surprising, I mean, the institution is in distress, and the curator is brand new, and he hasn't had much exposure to the institution before, so that's kind of important to appoint someone who understands the bank too well. And so the process takes very long. And so there will be a slow process of ensuring that everybody gets more than what they would have got into liquidation. Right. Then the second proposal relates to the following page, so section 3.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of reorganization. It doesn't mean too much. What has happened internationally, and is certainly an issue for us, is that holding companies or banks end up being after the supervisory next. And that is just how I think banks have become cleverer and cleverer and cleverer, is that a holding company will own banks. That means the holding company isn't necessarily subject to the same amount of oversight as the bank is subject to. And that can create some really interesting dynamics. So one of the things we're proposing in the Financial Sector Regulation Book is to allow holding companies to have the same level of supervisory indebtedness as the banks that they own. And sometimes the holding company actually owns 100% of the bank. At least in the country ratio, the holding company owns 100% of the bank.
Back to the key attribute. So the approach that Roy is advocating is a strong point in the key attribute. And it's the holding company and the other subsidiaries of the holding company as well. So in this case, again, I'm just going into what's publicly known. Hampton Bank is a subsidiary. It went into liquidation. The holding company or Avon, not under liquidation. A subsidiary of the holding company is equal to the bank in a sense, another subsidiary, LV, no liquidation. So if you had the new approach internationally, everything could have been put under liquidation. In this instance, what happens is the bank itself is under liquidation. The others will be done in terms of the Companies Act, Business Revenue, etc. They all separate processes, different laws.
Okay, and the final proposal is section 3J, which is to allow the director to raise funding on behalf of the bank that is in duration. Now, there is another piece of law that applies to this, and that's the Reserve Bank Act, which allows the Reserve Bank to lend money to an institution that's in duration under very specified requirements. But it's not clear that the Bank Act allows the curator to borrow money on behalf of the bank's industry. Now, we'll see in the comments tomorrow that there's a little bit of concern that this clause is too loosely drafted, and that it gives the curator the ability to raise money from anybody. It may be that the committee thinks we should narrow this and say specifically that the curator can only borrow money from the Reserve Bank, which I think will be perfectly fine, and that's something for the committee to consider and to ensure that they can get security for that. So that's really the major small little changes that we have proposed, that they are of themselves quite contentious. We have been having many meetings with stakeholders on the rules, and so we have a good sense of what the treaty view is on the proposals and on the submissions from stakeholders. I think many stakeholders have hired very good lawyers and have made some good suggestions. So certainly I'm not being quite if there are some small changes to the law. But there are some key issues I think that we need to be very clear on the treaty to not support, because that might put us in a quite difficult position. So really fair to the committee once we have opportunity to hear what the stakeholders think. We have consulted the directors, the Reserve Bank, senior counsel last year, and federal advisors. And last year we had even all major credit groups. This year we've met with major credit groups together and in their different categories. We have consulted at least four councils, Trenko, Bradley, Cooper, and also we have for the committee centers. Yeah, between us and the creator, we have at least consulted two of us and been part of the process of three of us. We have also circulated an opinion prepared for us by consultant Bradlenga on the constitutionality of the proposal. A very long opinion, very interesting. Essentially, it proposes that they feel that provided that the promotion of the Ministry of Justice Act follows, there are no problems with the proposal.
Just to be clear, we are giving you and we've made available legal opinion that we have directed the mission ourselves. The others, like Tenko, is done by the Canadian people. Great. So we've left it to them to whether they can make it available or not. But they,
We've always consulted the Banking Association and the CETA. The CETA is the association that looks after insurance companies, asset managers, and so forth. Both of them are related to the submission. CETA highlighted that there's been quite a consultation with their members, but they don't, because at the moment their members are very widely divergent views. They don't want to take a view on their behalf, but they highlight how much consultation has taken place. And the Bank Association, which means supportable. And then separately, and this is very important, we have consulted the banking consortium separately from the Banking Association. In actual fact, the Banking Association set up a very clear divide line between members of the consortium and other members internally. And that's just quite important part in the context of African bank curation. Part of the process is that the banking consortium will bring an additional 10 billion rand of new capital to the good bank. So they're going to be injecting capital. And so they have their own views on the law. There are separate problems the bank more generally, so we kept those two separately. But that will come up tomorrow just to highlight the sort of process.
Actually, that's an important point to note. I think when you have a bank crisis, like the etc., often what happens is you look for someone who wants to buy out the bank, almost always, okay? And so Western was close to JP Morgan, and so on. So in this case, the bank consortium has come forward and the political council forward. Obviously, I think the minister announced in the NCPDF, there is an underlying backstop provided by the Treasury, that's the word, formal guarantee wording in the bank itself, but we don't anticipate that it will be called up if there's a successful resolution, especially in terms of
the resolution is actually going reasonably well, so it looks like there will be no problem with the resolution as well. Okay, so so just to highlight who the stakeholders are, as well as highlight is some people that have put forward different positions, which is perfectly fine. Who the main people that we worry about? Most importantly, we worry about all these South Africans who just save money in the bank. We try for 100% coverage of these people, as well as highlight is in past years, we have measured that ordinary South Africans who save money in the bank will come out of whatever it is. And actually, that part of the resolution will be to take steps to develop the deposit guarantee scheme, which will make sure that depositors are protected up to a certain amount. And I think that's very important. I think people must feel that when they save money in their bank, that because of the regulated entity, that they feel that they will be able to get what they put in that. The second group of people are generally pension funds or money market funds. So often pension funds will invest in money market funds, and they will invest in the bank. Or pension funds will invest directly into that. And they tend to invest in a very safe instrument called the senior debt, or in the regulatory jargon tier one instrument. These have special rules, and they generally are designed in such a way that pension funds can be relatively guaranteed of what will come out if any problems develop. So they are first in line for any money in the QA ship. And there is a process that needs to be followed to ensure that their interests are protected. As we announced, this group of people are approximately 85% of the total cost. So they're 85% of the money that African banks owe. The announcement from the curator would be that this group would get 90% of their money back. So there's only the attempt to take up. They've got 44 billion that they've seen. We believe that 90% is quite relatively straightforward to achieve. The structure that has been proposed by creative will probably ensure that the pension fund, this is about 44 billion for the fund, will probably do quite well for the investment in a mock fund. We'll take only small losses. And in fact, what happens is on the morning of curatorship, a procedure was put in place where money market funds are out of pocketed, and so those losses have already been recognized on the money market fund, which I think was a very good move on the part of the money market fund managers, because that means that there's no concern now. People know exactly where they stand, and there are no additional losses possible.
Not on the morning, because it's like 15 minutes. What we saw was a run in my market fund, or potential run, and 13 that was arrested. And if you read, for example, internationally, the South was one of the first cases to break the buck and impose a form of income on my market fund.
So that means everybody who has money market funds, any closed African bank knows exactly where they stand. There will be no more money. In fact, they may come out better off, considering that the grade is actually doing quite well. So, you know, they may get a small benefit. We're promising. We're not promising. then another category called junior. It's also called subordinated. It's also called tier 2, depending on whether it's ring tree or whatever you think. These are generally higher risk types of instruments. Banks are required to issue these instruments sometimes in terms of how they go about getting regulatory capital. They generally have higher yields, so they pay more money back to the investors, but they come with some higher risk. They have quite cool names, so things be like an opportunity fund, for example. So if you've got some cool money and you want to invest it in full, you know, this is the sort of thing that you should maybe look at. In terms of, if you think about how your life cycle is, generally these are the sorts of instruments that younger people invest in because you could do very well over a long period of time. But if you're a pensioner, you should probably avoid this type of instrument because it doesn't come at the same level of protection than the senior tier one creditor.
Well, I don't want to get into financial trouble. Pension funds have trustees, which is very risky, and those that have invested will certainly lose out. Of course, I think when people come here and say pensioners have lost out, the question should be, why did you invest pension funds into this product knowing that it, do the trustees know? Because what the fund managers do and what, and the pension fund, I'm pretty certain many trustees, if you look at our retirement reform, aren't always fully aware of the risk they take when their fund managers put funds in certain types of funds. So anyway, but that's between them and their fund.
I just have to disclose that neither of us are already financial advisors, and we should not be held responsible for any financial advice continually. I think they help us take the high risk, and those are generally things like equity funds. So people know that they're taking a lot of risk. If you're younger, I won't provide a financial advice. Okay, so to be finalized, what are the main concerns? Protection, security, the balance, all the rights. We believe, I think we've highlighted all these things think about. There's a lot of concerns about the valuation of transferred liabilities, what constitutes their market value. That's a really difficult thing to determine. It's very difficult to write into a law, but the curator is always subject to legal challenge after the curator, and so if he cannot prove that he thought very carefully about the value at which he transferred the assets, then he is liable to legal challenge. And finally, there's a little bit of confusion, I think, out there about exactly where subordinated creditors lie relative to senior creditors. There's some legal opinions. I think we have about two sets of legal opinions, one thing, the other thing. Our legal opinion has been that the curatorship subordinated creditors are not treated the same as senior creditors. I think that's sort of consistent with the concept of what curatorship is trying to achieve.
Just on that point, and to get into the next slide. So what it gets to is, I think they'll put forward a view that, you know, it's funny about Sue, they need to be treated equally to the seniors until there's liquidation. We think, you know, when you put into relationship, you're there already, and that's the spirit of the approach that we take. It may well be that legally, of course, it's since he's been on law, he's been ultimately attached to decide whether he'd go by the letter of the law or obviously the spirit, which one prevails, etc. I think it's an issue. But yeah, just to conclude, I think that there are comments, and I think as you said, many of the comments certainly at value, but there are many red headings as well in the comments we see. Some of the comments, clearly I think it's important to check where they're from, because you are passing for the ticket. Certainly one seems that the senior creditors seem to be void. You have a whole lot of people who are the subordinated creditors, or tier two as they call themselves, perhaps not to reflect their junior status, who sort of have put objections. Some of them are very similar. Certainly it appears they've had a group and they've talked about their approach. So for example, some would say the bill is not constitutional. And in fact, as I said, if you take their opinion seriously, it means the entire Banking Act for the last 20 years has been not constitutional. And it would mean that we have unique dispensation on how to resolve banks compared to other parts of the world. If you look at some of the comments go against, I think, international trends as well, as I said that. And I think that the one that says when they loan the bank up to 22 hours and Basel 3 didn't apply, so they serve the Basel 2 and up, and had they made loans after Basel 3 took effect in 2013, and it could be different, therefore they needed to have received it differently. I really think it's a red herring. I think if you look at Northern Rock and so on, they were all under Basel 2. When there was a crisis, the UK had to act, it acted. So I think the Basel 2, 3 is one issue, but the bigger question I'll ask is, were you sleeping between 2008 and 2012? Looks like the modern day looks fundamental to me. Did they not see what was happening in other parts of the world? Did they not think that there would be risk as well, that it could come here as well? And frankly, I think that given the credit bubble that you had, and given the dubious practices of guarantee orders and so on, I do think that there was a lot of greed, a lot of very high returns from lending and then rejecting people to pool guarantee orders, debit order gaming, and send abuses that you identified and if you want to stamp out and if you are in process of stamping out. So why they didn't see this earlier? And to make the point, you know, people have been raging bull horns even last week. They were amongst the biggest losers. You know, they didn't see it. So you've got to ask, did greed come in a way? Because the returns were very high. But perhaps they didn't never, you know, why the Celtic one doesn't know. So to conclude, as I said, we're open to comments and amendments. I think like with all legislation. Because we've had many clever people who run funds but don't seem to understand the parliamentary process. As soon as the bill was published, they thought it was already in the law. And already accusing us of writing this bill, etc. They don't seem to know how legislation goes through, so like with all legislation, we're hoping to make amendments as lawyers said. But we must always have the principle, investors to invest, must also understand the risk and take responsibility for that. As you said, the current option just provides a further option, and whether the creator ultimately uses it or doesn't use it is really up to the creator. You're going to see a lot of lawyers, and I think while we talk generally on African banks, because the urgency is around African banks, we've steered clear from any of operational details, and I would appeal to members that when the creator comes to talk about the legislation, it's important that you don't get into the operational detail of the creatorship. In a sense, the creator needs to be protected from doing his work. This case is always a he, so I can say he is a he. I'm not known as a woman creator in South Africa. I don't know why. The gender issue is clearly there. And I think that the key question to ask as people come is, do these amendments give any credit or stakeholder worse off than in a normal situation in terms of winding down, as we call it, in the protection situation? Or do these amendments leave any credit or also worse off than in the current standard? Thank you, Chair. I should emphasize here that I do think that after you get input tomorrow, I just want to say it's a little bit difficult for the department to really respond by Thursday. Because part of the response is the short bill, but we're going to have to consult with senior counsel and go through this. So it's quite a process. I just want to urge you to that, Chair.
Let me clarify that. When I said we were proceeding to this bill, I'm talking about the auditing bill, which you will tell the authority you want to impose at the beginning of the financial year. So you'll be clear about what you want. So you said that. Yeah, that's the first bill. That's the bill we're going to proceed with immediately after the public hearing. I don't know how to communicate it to your, with myself or not anyway, or public hearing. But we were even asked to try to proceed with the last year. So on the bill, we agree to vote today, the executive should have no choice if you need that bill. So we said we'll proceed with the extension, which is what we did. We committed to postpone what we said last year, and we'll proceed immediately to the morning with the auditing bill. And then we took it that the FAC bill is intended. So we'll proceed with that. As soon as we finish the auditing bill, we don't then pan out that we're finished, but we're sitting for all day tomorrow on the Thursday. Now, we didn't change it as a country store right now. Apart from your concerns about having to prefer, we also need to put our research team together. So I can see us dealing with this local team. But if it comes to you, we can start. So we're not asking you to come up fully prepared to respond. I want to say that if you're not engaging with the stakeholders, you put this bill into public domain together. You will help the peace submission. Now, I don't understand the way that things work. Often, almost always, the stakeholders will make representations to present a version of the bill by the executive, and the rules are counted part of each and every act. And, you know, I wasn't really open to comment on that, and good, but ultimately, Parliament has to have this. And we've taken into account what the executive says, we've taken into account what the stakeholders say. You've gone one step ahead. In a way, you have input the response of the proposal committee, the standing committee, to what we'll hear tomorrow, which is fine, sure, right? But presumably those who are here, representing the structure, the stakeholders who are here, will take into account what you are saying. So the way you're facilitating the selected folks, apart from a formal submission to us, they will no longer have to respond to the things you say, or what they have said, after that. And I think some of them have, because I don't think we can have the same decision. It's not the usual process stands up here. They look like a lawyer that's getting referred to. So presumably they heard you and they will respond to you. Now, the second thing to say is contrary to what you suggest, I'm keeping it again, they're only four prepared for submission. And we've allocated 15 minutes. Maybe each other, you need quite a few 20 minutes to respond. Because you will have read by tomorrow, certainly by the time we come to the summary submission. So we will give you a chance to reply also to them. And even they should be there when you do so. Because you want to ask them to respond to what you say. Right? So again, both sides represented adequately in the processing of the bill. It's the way you've been doing it anyway. Because the committee is asking it, and that's how we're doing now until somebody comes from the committee to present that to them. So having said that, on the legal issues, where are alert right now? Can we ask for all the legal opinions you've got, as well as anything you have, because then you'll provide them and you'll give it a question. What those who are saying, have they, that's not constitutional, have they given you legal documents that they said, have they consulted or it's not? So you don't have any legal opinion from their side. Sorry?
Just clarify, we don't have one legal opinion and that's from the curator. We have not seen any legal opinion.
Presumably, I think there's five people who are coming tomorrow. If they have a legal opinion that explains why the bill is unconstitutional, they will submit it to us. So we will give it to Advocate Jenkins and his team immediately. So they can start looking at the constitutionality of the bill. Because what we're finding is often these bills are going to cross, and then it seems, I mean, I'm wrong, and then several times, if not the majority of times, Parliament's finding that the bills that are being protested are actually in some other form of breach of the constitutional legislation. We don't want that. We can avoid it. So we can start immediately with whoever that team will be greeting with honor, who's the head? Yeah, you could probably say that.
Having said that, can I throw it open to the floor? Questions, please, John? Comments, whatever?
Thank you very much, Jesus, and thanks for the presentation. Very interesting. Something. You talk about the urgency of this act. Now, I do understand you explain why you would want this to happen, etc. But it certainly does on the face that it looks like a crime, you know. And I really don't want it to look that way, but it does. Especially the urgency. Have you set up consequences for African banks if this bill is not passed? I know we spoke about half the problems, but you know, what is the really meaning if that should happen? And then, on the issue of duration, now I'm sure you're aware that in the retirement fund industry there's been an enormous amount of problems with curatorship regarding the fees that are charged by curators, the activities of the curators, the fact that they go through the whole time, etc. Now I know it's a slightly side issue, but certainly we're going to give a lot more power to curators, especially in the banking sector. What does it mean in terms of the price that people have paid for this service? And then on the issue, finally, on the constitutionality of the bill, I did actually read the document together while we were presenting. And there are two things that they talk about. They certainly talk about the section 69.2c, I think it's probably where they're talking about some changes that they suggested. Now that's not in the whole, so the question is why did they put it there? If that is, you know, your view of it is. And then also the issue of retrospectivity. They said that if it was going to withstand constitutional matter, this whole issue needs to be thought about. And also they said the suggestion was that you specifically have to say the bill which you want to apply to African banks. Now you haven't put any in either. So if you may explain that. Thank you.
Okay. The research team is going to be very simple. One is, we have raised repeatedly the need for some sort of overview to begin with on where things are with the committee for the bank, Africa Bank, right? We are constantly told that there are some sensitivities, markets and other means. You can't raise some of these things in the public domain yet, but we have some understanding that in the first quarter of this year, you will come back to us give us some account of progress, some lessons learned, but I think they incorporate the issues in this book and the like. So firstly, can you let me know when you're going to come to life? We need to get some understanding of what's really happening in the African world, a keen sense of what the issues are, and of course it might influence on the world that might approach it from this book. The second thing is, I'll drop that one because you've covered it later. I also noticed, by the way, it comes to the point I'm making on slide 3. It's a trivial thing, but I think you say it's really the bill is not constitutional. You don't say it's constitutional, but it's really one of the earlier matters. But on this one, I'll cover the ground really. We have to check constitutionality. That would be reasonably upfront because, you know, it's looking at certain parts of the bill. If the parliament of the bill is constitutional, so the way we're going to proceed with the bill, I don't think it will be otherwise. If you look at the constitutionality of the 12 subjects of the decision. I thought you'd also assume to be aware. If any kind of some stakeholder or other will work on it, is unhappy about something that they say under the rush of the court. So we're not saying that. We're also acutely aware that at the end of the day, it's the depositors that have to be protected, the taxpayer has to be sort of at the end of the day, I need to say aside. So there are some broad principles, I think, in the minority party that can signal the outset. Like, you know, we will set out this, you know, after having a meeting and some consultation, a broad framework around which we think the bill should be proceeded. You know? So that we can look at technical issues within that proper framework. There are some valid principles, policies of the ANC that will define the framework in which we look at the technical issues. But obviously, all of our citizens can read. You should be aware of what, you know,
2008 fully admit for the poor disadvantaged institution. And for the cause more generally, close enough for international. Okay, having said that, can you reply? Is there anything present shown to the time of the race? No. Okay, this is the first deal. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. The PBO hasn't been engaged with so many details as we have in the text, but obviously as always we're available to do so. I guess to add that there's some benefits we've seen thus from 16 parties seem to be and as you were saying, whether credit is reasonably 14, what's going to happen, that's the economic side of linking into the constitution. But if the committee wants to do so, the rest of course we can. It will be useful to know if it doesn't need to be doubled immediately this week, what the timelines might be, so we can also plan accordingly.
Now, what you say about that? I think this is, we've just come back from constituency play. This is our very first city. We had engaged this very afternoon, the research team will meet with me, and David is available, to look at how we proceed. We have no intention of rushing this book, although we recognize some of the, it's a very complex, challenging problem. So we need to get our research team, our legal team and so on working. We need more time to go through the book carefully. So obviously, once we've had public hearing, we will, before we proceed with the bill, hear the stakeholders, and then begin to hear about some of our broad policy positions. So this is just an issue for us. So. Okay. The last thing that struck me, Wilma, I'm not sure what the meaning of that is, but we can come back to it. This is the argument that strikes me, but it's my tentative thing as well, but I haven't approached it. You know, I'm saying, look, the trustees of the nation, we're lose out, then it's a consequence of, taking the chance. But it's not the trustees that ultimately bear the pensions. Now, the average pension doesn't really have a sense of where the money should be invested and so on. So, in that one section, I'm sure you speak about that, it's going to be some of our broader values. You've got the thing of, is it 20, I think it was for 25, I think, you say pension should avoid this type of instrument. But it's not a pension. The trustee is the pension fund, right? So we have to predict the pension that sometimes even against the trustee. That's a matter we need to look at, right? Having said that, nobody else is presenting, then over to you.
Thanks, Chen. Apologies, I'm actually very happy that you're going to not rush this book. That was never the intention, because I think not only that it's critical for democracy, but I think we'll go wrong if we were to rush this book. We do need it.
Yes. Parliament, this committee will never agree to any topic we don't understand. If we don't understand, we just stop. And we get experts from Mongolia, perhaps.
Yes.
So yes, not Russia.
So thank you for that. I think that just didn't want you to feel that certainly the department's not putting any pressure on the committee. Obviously, I think we'd like to keep part sometime in the first part of this year, but, just to answer Uncle George's question, no, there's no crisis. The crisis certainly was there in August last year, and the curatorship clearly has introduced an audit process. The issue still is that with the options that there are, we're trying to maximize what creditors can get out. Okay. To the extent that if the creditor is forced to use liquidation, they're going to be hit harder. Okay. There's also then some risk, since we said, for example, 10% haircut, I believe, sort of saying that you'll get back 90% of your money to the senior creditors, it may have some implications for the fiscal. And so we are obviously trying to minimize, in fact, as I said, get to zero, to ensure that taxpayers don't pay for this problem. I don't think Roy wants to add. So there's no crisis, and it's not very urgent, but it's going to be done tomorrow. But it will provide further option to the curator. And if the curator is able to exercise that and use it in this instance, we believe it would be a better outcome for all, because we've pointed out the principle that no debtor should be worse off through this amendment. I think with regard to maybe Roy can go ahead.
No, actually, I think that the impression that's created because of what happened in the last year, there were some delays, the book being published, etc. Some people thought that there were some other things going on. I mean, what you see in the festival is probably the question. There's no rush.
So, just with regard to the issue of creators and fees, George is also running close to our heart. I think that these are issues. I can tell you from the pension fund, I'm sure the rates are going to be much, much, much more expensive. And of course, the staff is managing that, and I'm sure they will have to ensure that there's a balance between getting the right expertise, because they've had strong expertise, for example, from the UK and so on, but that it's not out of whack with the benefits that there are, and there hopefully are some limits, but it is another ball game, just the relationship when you play for a large bank, quite different from pension funds. But I think the similar issues need to apply, that there needs to be a lot of oversight over their expenses to make sure that they're not wildly out of range with what's expected in this case. And of course, the public incentive, the longer you stretch the incentive, the relationship, and how you're going to pay to the creators. So, and obviously the sooner can sensitively dissolve the link between the various players, the better it would be from a cost perspective. But I don't know, Johan, if you want to come in on that. Sorry, if you just introduce yourself from the top.
Myself, I'm not from the outside of, from the production of those banks, and I just didn't realize where you were sitting in the form. But anyway, what I want to say is, what cost of creation, the act actually allows for the investor to enter into an agreement with the creator. So in that way, the costs are actually controlled and curved. So there has to be an agreement between the investor on bank and the creator on top before you can do that. So that's the mechanism in the act. This issue of prolonging the process, are there any mechanisms provided for to make sure that the data is not related to such a way that they prolong it to the community and then they
Well, the problem that one always has is when you're a putting director, there's always a benefit to the director on the one side, because the director can actually, it takes longer than the director, obviously get more fun. And therefore, the directorship is actually conducted under the control of the registrar. So in other words, the director, if the registrar decides at the point in time that they listen enough, then the registrar can actually apply for the credit. Or the registrar, before the registrar appoints the director, the registrar can also then appoint somebody else, depending on the circumstances. So there is this control. But I hope there are only some things one must recognize. And that is that, and I think it's also true in the situation, that these things can sometimes be just controlled as well. It can actually have a life of its own. You can actually get your money out of the credit. It's something that's on control. The mechanism is there.
So it's something we need to watch, and we need to watch that we're watching that as well. Because, it's a minimal point to create, but it's on the recommendation of the registrar, and the day-to-day reporting and management of the creator should be done by the registrar of banks. So that's an important point to note. I think this with regard to the changes, and Roy can come in. The legal opinion was only secured after the bill was published, so it did go to the state law advisors, etc. And obviously, was in response also to some of the, and the reason why I responded and we did want to preempt what people are going to come and say, but these discussions have been going on as Joy has outlined. And so we just want to be certain in our own minds that the bill is, well, to be safe for us, maybe because I've been a mathematician, but then you get not guilty as well in instance. But today it's not unconstitutional, but you know, I think what we are saying is that we think it's constitutional. That our legal experts like Ampli can come in on that. But so we just received that. We did get a draft earlier. And obviously the recommendations that they make are quite open to that. But for a lawyer, Ampli hasn't.
I think considering the state of law is a very good advance on constitutionality and their advance to the constitutional party, but it can't be brought to cabinet before the constitutional party tables before the state of advance has agreed to the constitution.
Yeah.
But you know, we have this, after the public, we have people saying it's well, so we just double check really.
Right,
so
we'll just
tell you.
Okay.
With regard to, I think, raised with curators, I think just when they are able to get some info at the appropriate time to come, and obviously if we can't take you until the no report until the curatorship is over, because then it might be 20 years. I think that the issue is certainly at an initial stage, certainly to provide a report. Let us talk to the curators and see what they can tell us, but I think we are mindful of that.
The Brazilian industry committee has asked for some for report, and I spoke with the chair, and we agreed. She will pursue the matter further. We have a joint session of the two committees sometime in the first quarter. So, we have to have some sort of working for this.
Okay. Okay, so we'll come back to you. Okay, just on the other questions very quickly. I think, certainly the issue of the impact of the poor, I mean, 2008, you saw the impact, loss of jobs, etc. And that's why, when people don't understand why you bail out banks, the fact is because you say there should be an innocent, less expensive to come. And because banking is about confidence, and you say you have the facts, so you hope the money is never going to be used, but you have to show that you are behind that bank. And that's why we want our supervisors to be operationally independent. They must be able to do their job. And of course, the bigger question later, once the relationship is over, to say what were the reasons this amongst the regulators? Why was the model approved? Certainly, and keep in mind that we can be very wise after the event. But clearly we need to learn from our mistakes. So certainly when we look at certain peaks, our issue has been that there are structural weaknesses in our system. In fact, in this instance, remember it's not in the South alone, the banking supervisors. You've got the National Credit Regulator. You've got the FSB, so the insurance regulator, which is an insurance company that's involved. It's very, very complex. And it's very hard to figure out exactly what, and that's why normally once the relationship is over at some point you try and get an objective process to understand what the problems were. This is regards to trustees and pension funds. I think when we came on time before, this is a big area we're looking at, that clearly their trustees really aren't up to the job, not doing what they're supposed to do. They often operate as the PMs or fund managers, the incentive structure is wrong. And you still want to make sure that you can protect pensioners. So part of it is how you improve the trustees. Part of it is you do probably need to be more paternalistic to make sure that the trustees are doing their job and sort of in some way providing the maximum protection as possible. So that's it.
Thank you. Just on Richard's facility issue, I think there's a bit of confusion on what exactly we propose. And I think that the legal opinion is very helpful. I think that the budget and health has certainly clarified the retrospectivity issue. In their opinion, this is not at all retrospective, and the reason for that is because the things that are envisioned to happen in African bank creation have not happened yet. That is the transfer of liability. And transfer assets, they have not taken place yet. So, in actual fact, the creator will wait until the law is passed before he does those things. I think it's a very important principle because we do not want to use legislation that he would use retrospectively. And the proposal from Mr. Holter is that we clarify that, and we've been quite open about this as well as we gave the opinion. Is that we clarify that those apply to creations that are currently underway. So that's all we're trying to say. So there are no actual retrospectivity because you will not be doing anything that is not the other problem.
The weak form of this retrospectivity.
Good, okay, can you see this in both?
You're welcome. And we also, I know with regret that Cindy always had a little mishap. I'm sure not the first time that she was in the committee. Not being the first time, more than we see. But we hope you have had a 50 of the phone.
Sorry. I thought we
gave you the new one.
Sorry? I thought we gave you the new
one. We gave you the new one for that. Yeah.
Okay. Fully aligned, also with the PMA.
then there's also the requirement that in our view that in lacking in those particular sections, section 2.1 part of the Constitution by introducing letters for determining the remuneration of SHG members. Now section 2.5 of the Constitution, 2.9 part of the Constitution requires that the matching legislation that sets out a framework for determining the salaries and allowances of members. All constitutional commissions and the provision that was in the current act in our way is lacking in that regard. As we go from the main amendments in the bill, the third one, and this is not in the order of the provisions in the bill, obviously in a conceptual discussion on rules before we get them, but one of the key ones is to shift the functions of the chief executive and accounting officer from the chairperson to a new position, an administrative position in the commission of CEO. So apparently the act provides that the chairperson of the commission is also the chief executive and accounting officer. The proposal is that the CEO that's now in the administration and the accounting officer and also the secretary to the commission. And the reason for this proposal is that it will remove the anomaly of the chairperson being the team and the accounting officer while the commission should exercise oversight with regard to the functions of the chief executive and accounting officer. The reason is just in the parallel. The proposal in the bill is that the CEO should be appointed for a contract not up to more than 5 years, but this contract may be renewed. Then another key amendment is to highlight the role of the SEC in the organization and to state that it is relevant to determine and oversee the decisions through the direction and operational policy of the SEC. So that's an amendment in clause 3. And then what I indicated earlier is the proposed alignment of the functions of the SEC, including the nature of its functions, making recommendations and not giving advice or serve as a consultative body accounting stated in the Act. And this is proposed to be done by simply referring to section 221 of the Constitution. So we don't repeat the language of the Constitution in the Act. Then there's also proposals regarding the requirements on how the agencies are conducted and the signs of powers are protected. And there's a requirement when there's all the state that shift functions from one sphere of government to another that can consult the SEC and all claim the relations of the SEC on those signs The further amendment is deals with the SEC membership, and there's a couple of amendments. There is a provision currently in the Act that says vacancies must be fostered in 90 days, and we propose that it should be more flexible in another budget actually as soon as practicable. So we propose that we say it should be within a reasonable period. Another proposal in the bill is currently there's no provision regulating whether members serve on a full-time or part-time basis. So it's left to the president to be making the appointments, the appointments on a full-time or part-time basis. So the proposal in the bill is now that members should be appointed on a part-time basis. Then there's also a proposal in the bill that members should not serve more than 10 consecutive years. It should be noted that the bill doesn't stipulate the period of appointment up to 5 years, so members should be appointed 1, 2, 3, or 4 years. That's why we have this proposed wording of 10 consecutive years. Then also another provision, review of the proposal that all members should be part-time for these. Currently one full-time member on the commission, and the advice is that we should protect the current full-time status of members. So if there's a full-time member at this time, there's also some law that person will remain a full-time member till the end of the appointed term of that member. What I alluded to earlier is the proposed provision to give effect to section 2.195 of the Constitution. This is introduced a method for the term in the narration and other conditions of service of members of the commission. I think important in that is that we align this to provisions in a law that was passed by Parliament in 2014, and that act was called the Determination of Affairs of Independent Constitutional Institutions Laws Amendment Act 2014. This act only covered Chapter 9 institution and one other institution. Although we actually hope that it would cover the SEC as well, but it does not. The proposal is now that we have the same provisions in the SEC Act than in this Act. What it entails, the proposal is the Independent Commission to Information Public Officers must conduct an investigation on the operation and conditions of service. And that recommendation goes to the President, and then President then will make a determination. But that determination is subject to approval by the National Assembly. And this process is the same for these other, or Chapter 9 institutions in the Constitution. Then also in order to accept this amendment, there's a requirement to amend the Independent Commission for the Narration of Public Officers Act. Basically, the definition has acted to the constitutional institutions and the amendment includes the SEC and in that definition. Then another area of regulation in the bill that there is limited provision in the Act currently simply just saying that the amendment is an interest in a matter before the commission they must recuse themselves. It's proposed that there are more detailed provisions in the bill. Essentially, saying that some of good faith without fear, favor, and prejudice. And this kind of provision you will sometimes find in the Constitution, but in the case of the SEC, there's no such provision. Then also provision to discuss personal or private business interests. And then there's also requirements or prohibition on the use of the member's position for private gain of the benefit third party improperly. Then a further key amendment is that we propose that there's currently a tower amendment to make regulation. We propose that this tower is replaced by a tower for the commission to make rules. Being a constitutional institution that the executive does not discuss regulation or the commission to conduct business. You will note in the body two types of rules. The first kind of rules are internal rules, like the conduct of employees and so on, procedures and minutes of the commission. And those rules don't need to be published. And then there's a second set of rules, and that's on how all the states must request if you see recommendations, maybe about funding on witnesses. That would apply to the external parties, and those rules must be published in the Gazette in terms of the proposal involved. Then you will also note in the mention there's some alignment with the TFMA in terms of the initial financial year, and also the tracing of certain reports to use the either referring to the TFMA or repeating the language of the TFMA. Then there's also a mention that deals with the requirement or the SEC of the need information to do their work. The section is a bit ambiguous, but it's part of the dealing with access information held by, which is now such as a. And then in the second section, it deals with saying that if those institutions are funded by the revenue fund, national or provincial or municipalities, then they must provide that information free of charge. Obviously, that doesn't cover all organs of state that someone not funded, maybe self-funded, or doesn't cover people in the private sector if they require information from them. The proposal is to expand this provision to make it clear that the FEC can request information on any organ of state or in person. then some of the other amendments, the more technical ones, is a couple of definitions in clause one, defining chief executive officer, defining the intended provision of the remuneration of public officers, and so on. And then also proposed to use some obsolete terminology, there's some references to state departments, and also the use of the term official, and now using the term employee, which is really some of the references under the Public Service Act. There is also a provision that we propose to repeal, because it's simply just repeating what's in the Constitution, and it's already wanted unnecessary to do that. Then there's also a couple of sections dealing with the previous HSC and the transitional arrangements, which is no longer necessary, and we propose that that be repealed. So those are the main amendments. And there's some of the other technical amendments to the call. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. I do understand that the text of the bill, what proof is going to be written, right? There's nothing beyond what the Treasury of the Parliament that you want amended in this text.
Indicated that when it is indicated there is just one method that changed, other things are coming forward that we only became aware of when we came back from. So we haven't had the opportunity to have the conversation with the Minister or Treasurer because the things are not very publicly to us. So it's just one method that relates to whether all commissioners must be part of the commission has a different view to that. That's the only thing that changed. But otherwise, the rest of the matters that have been on the terms of the commission is fully happy with. We were busy, guided by you also putting together our issues around why we believe that Chairperson must remain a full-time appointment because our major concern was the conflation of not the content of the word, but the conflation of the position was the major concern.
Now we had a meeting with the minister, and in fact, it that they were going to put this report to the ministry that this was coming in. In fact, it came up to the council's president, obviously, they didn't work on it even before we went into that. The matter of part-time full-time, can you discuss it with Treasury and the Minister of Commerce and their legal analysis in this? If you don't, then how the government applies to that issue. But please, the Minister, I don't know how the Minister is going to be still available given the budget coming up, so, but I do think it seems sufficient to be available. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. Over to you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just a little change with Ariana, who has done the first project at the Ministry. And also at the beginning of the question of the different measures. And the agency in terms of the cabinet, one is the on what are the best issues, what are in the Constitution.
Sunday over there. So that will remain confusion in our approach in terms of the that we want to take. But to me it sounds that there are two constitutional aspects that we're not taking into consideration in terms of the mandate of the area. Maybe it is influenced by the fact that the common organization has then when the principles of the organ of the constitution remains important in the decision that we take. So if we can and it's intended for harmonization again, but having and we would take into consideration practicality of implementation of it. But to me, the gist of the matter is the practicality and the need to adapt to experience in implementation of it. And that's the issue that we need to answer and that, I still remember, I think he was going to come out with it and say, I put a lot of work on my shoulders. I can see that picture, and I think it's something that you want to consider at one point. I'm not interested in the comments that I'm saying, we're looking at. And it will also be informed by the practicality, the fact that the practicality, I don't care who's the person, so every time they look at the person, the person, the person. So we are here to interview to make that relationship.
And
unfortunately, we don't know how we're going to figure out these things for us before they go away. So both teams have to keep that so that we can. You might come to an end of all the things, though. We come out and say, this is for us, and then start the report for us. As far as I know, for us, there are no solutions from the public sector. You resist, so am I correct? For public comments?
No. Only we just keep an eye on the same thing.
You have received nothing from any stakeholder in your time. And we have advertised for the bond, and we received nothing. So in that sense, it's really a law that we can move at least in the sake of consultation issues, please ask them. And my own view is this is a law issue. It's a bit surprising that the number of issues that you've identified that we need to end, all of which issues should have been done a while back, if you think about it. There's nothing here that's issued in the last year and a month or two. So let's then tell them that there's a technology so that we should finish this as we can. Okay, that's it. We're over. Next vote is a policy vote. We've had a hearing already, having a briefing already. And we just want to keep issues to remind us, having been out of the parliamentary system for forever. What are the key issues, and then we start processing until tomorrow in the afternoon.
I'm going to pronounce one of our colleagues from Irma and also a colleague from the accounting general's office. I'm going to pronounce, I think, the one I'm wrong. That's the first one, this is from Edward Lane Captain, and then my apology to Robert. I'm not sure why not. Karen is from the Accounting General's office. So there was this question, I don't know the number of questions that was raised at the previous meeting. We did write to the chairperson to indicate some information that were required. Content of the Audit Protection Act of 2005. It is established forever and it provides for education, training and professional development courses. And also there are laws forever with regard to the accreditation of professional bodies of registered auditors or both accountants and registered auditors. It also provides actually for the registration of auditors and then the regulation of the conduct of auditors. I'm saying registered auditors because that's the term defined in the Act. It's a bit of a peculiar thing. But we all, and I'll mention it later, is that, or maybe in our response to the ones that mention it for if we come to that point that tomorrow or the next day, is that we are busy with a review of the whole Act. This is one of the notes we'll look at, because I think it's very clumsy the way it's currently. That's my personal view. Then, just to highlight, and I'm sure my colleagues can add if there's questions, is that the current step to become an auditor first and understand your relevant degree, then they serve in Article 12 in terms of the training contract, and then they complete the public practice examination, and then they may register as an auditor. The process to become a registered auditor is also the examination of the public practice examination. And first time candidates intending to write the final assessment of qualification as a chartered accountant will have to write assessment of professional competence of the Tri-Talk Asset Institute of Chartered Accountants. So that's really the requirement. Now, the assessment of professional competence is a general assessment of competence required to tell the accountant, and it's not an assessment specifically for audit competence. Therefore, ERGO replaced the public-private examination with the audit development program, And that's also attached to the letter, the details of that program for members to read. And now this program entails that an assigned auditor order will come in candidate auditor before they get stagnant auditor, and it entails the peers in say specialized as technical accountants before they become registered auditors. This program aims to consolidate and define some of what is developed within the training program in terms of the training contract that is as an offshore club. And this will be in a much more complex learning environment from those more senior to those undertaking under current training. The example of recognition of completing audits on their own or under the supervision of often registered auditors. The audit development program is to commence in 2015 and I invited to register first candidate auditors in March 2015. Now the current auditing statement act does register candidate auditors and therefore we propose that everybody authorized to register candidate auditors and inside the account of the training and they will undergo for being candidate auditors. And then I like that because what is currently what to be done under this program already happens in practice. Most qualified CS firms work for many years before they are their partner and they require to register as auditors. And they indicate that under this program they will work on a more senior level and under the supervision of the registered auditors. And also what we've seen is a close relationship between candidate auditors, oversight auditors of a particular firm, and so they serve on the government to ensure more volunteer auditors. What we've also highlighted in the letter is that the role of oversight ensure that we have skilled and competent auditors that are responsible to the needs of the public in a manner that protects the public. And also the indicator that is one of the questions that was asked that there will be no additional jam at the end of the program and the candidate will be required to submit a portfolio of evidence of work done under the audit program. Now to go into the details of the bill, all the amendments in the bill relate to the proposed regulation of candidate auditors, and then there's also a couple of changes to update the reference to the Companies Act, in some instances we actually have to replace it with new substantive provisions which is not stated for in the Companies Act. Just to highlight the reasons regarding candidate auditors, the definition in proposed definition is that it's individuals who have obtained a professional accountant designation from a credited professional body and served under the supervision of a registered auditor. So obviously we need to include candidate auditors in the requirements for the registration. And we'll also need to fall under the scope of responsibilities in matters of persistence to ensure the protection of the public. And then, as I indicated earlier, was the purpose of standard audit is to more back to the exposure for working under a registered auditor. The amendment that pertains to the Companies Act. It's obviously the definition of Companies Act has been updated. And then there's a couple of other changes listed here. We need to go into the details there also when we do the call by call. I can highlight the particular amendment proposed in the section. So those are the changes relating to the Companies Act. Does my colleagues want to add something?
No, can you just comment on that? Is there anything else you want to do?
Anything else?
I think
think the one other aspect there was a request for a breakdown of printed audit, which is attachment was provided.
Sandy, John? Sandy?
We have seen here in Parliament legislation that to get professional bodies based on the international standards, but such legislation in one way or the other has actually clashed with the BEE principles that we have adopted as a discussion. You would have engineers, for instance, that having gone through examinations at universities and have with excellent distinctions, being assessed by certain regulatory bodies that have made it very difficult for such engineers to function. In the military industry, you had a situation where you had a test that those who wanted to be pilots had to go through when they had passed with an other subject with excellence. What is it called?
What? That is a
psychometric test that has made people only in South Africa to fail psychometric tests, but they go in other countries, they pass the psychometric test. I'm happy that the minister has actually raised the issue of the racial breakdown. Because more often than not, people who have failed the regulatory regime that has been introduced by the so-called professional bodies, have actually been black accounted. Now, this legislation seeks to what it determined kind of practice by ranking examination. I don't know experts in that regard, but we would want to get a different opinion from different people, how they feel about this and how relevant is it to them. If you allow, sure. I'm going to leave it to you. Because assessment of competence, if you pass the examination at university level, who determines if you pass at university level? Who is making this assessment for your competence? By registration as a professional accountant is basic. I'm also interested in this development program, multi-development program, what it is to achieve and how the intake and how to qualify and how many people need to go to it and intentions. This portfolio of evidence is about the experience that you've gone through, and you know, I'm interested in that. So that it should not be a limiting tool for you becoming an auditor, but a determining factor to actually empower you to be able to find yourself being an auditor, given the challenges in terms of racial groups we have in terms of auditors in the current context. So, if we can be clear from this, then I'm not hearing, because we want professional competence and skilled people in all the fields, as long as we also take into consideration what happened in the past and the challenges we had and the limitations we still have. Even today, we still have very few students who do apply mathematics. The Minister of Education has just indicated that the annual national assessment has actually yielded very limited results in terms of people who pass even mathematics in this context. So how do we make sure that with these institutions we make that to work and have very people in numbers who qualify to be audited? Because we need them. Certain tools have been a limiting factor, so how do we uplift that and approve it so that it should not be there? But we in sync with what we're trying to achieve as a state, as a democratic and a developmental state. So that full reform can be in progress if you allow, if you take my concern into consideration, that we can look at that, then we can inform the discussion taking forward.
Regarding
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. I think the excellent question could take some time out. Contrast development to the profession but I'm actually surprised that there aren't quite more submissions with regards to various stakeholders, which makes me ask the question of how wide the consultation is there with the legislation, for example, how wide the consultation with various stakeholders. I've got some of the colleagues with the profession, which I was thinking of this, like development and suggesting quite a lot of criticism as another term to say, in terms of system has made it so difficult for many accountants to get through to recognize. So I think it's very interesting what Honorable can say now. And also the event research auditors, can you just break down to us? You did say that you would break down to us, because I know that the research is the accountants, you know, can you just clarify the issue for the community there? And also the PPD is in this Continuous Accounting Act, and the APC, what's the difference in content? What does it, you know, can you just break it down for other people for that? And also one of my colleagues is the issue of quality, you know, because the computer system is supposed to be producing quality research also. What is the legislation looking to? Is there specific measures to ensure the quality of the ministers? Some of my colleagues who were in the profession say that how does it ensure the quality is not lost within the process? And there's also a specific I see the candidate will have to stay some time before they get the certificate of professional development. Is there specific intention in terms of how long would that be of? Would that be dependent on the research order from which the country will be overseen by, or is there a specific intention to implement that from the legislation? Of course, we have not. It's a basic one, I mean, that's going to get started as well. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe, Alan, you should look at the last meeting we had on the We've put a lot of questions. I mean, all the questions and answers in the minister's letter of the 21st of November committee. You can be assisted by the PM, previous. Secondly, the main theme, if I recall correctly, was the issue that Tanya, she might have raised and to us about meeting international standards, improving our auditing capacity and competency and standards, but at the same time not excluding people from disadvantaged backgrounds from becoming officers. I mean, that was in fact a main thing, to which the minister has replied. Now, I don't know if there was an attachment. We asked about the breakdown. But in the solution, I don't have that, but presumably all members have got it right. So there is actually, we just need to look at it before we meet, because it's sent to you as a hard copy, presumably, in your packages. I don't know this one is there, but there is a breakdown, an initial breakdown. Sorry? Yes, it is. It's a one-pager. Yeah, okay. So that's a comparison of insurance, gender, race, profile of RFBA. You need a insurance, yeah. I think that we should look at this and comment, right? But the theme that Sandy raises, it is also in a few, but yeah, we can give you a copy. The theme that Sandy raised is exactly the main theme that was raised at Conference when we had a briefing on the vote in November. Would that not be correct? Yeah. Right. So, really what we have to do is look at the minister's letter, look at this table, those who don't have it on your email, but we can give you a hard copy, and also hear what you have to say today. So, over to you. Ask a question, learn from Sandy. I think if I'm correct, Sandy is saying that we should also confer with African or black or generally auditors. Now the question is there, like I know there's an accountant, a BAFA or something they call it. I think it's the accountant for black or African, I'm not sure. So is there such a thing for auditors? Or do they cover auditors also? Because what we could do is then know there is an organized structure
of, like, you have NAF, the National Association of Farm Workers, Farmers Union, and then you have the other one, which also represents African farmers. Similarly, is there an association of representatives for auditors? If so, which one? And then we can get Alan to send us for the NAF and comment on it.
I've been all the questions of six conversations, my colleagues, and colleagues from several. Thank you. Just to clarify a few points that I can say, Lindsay Jotlani, I'm in the Education Training and Application Services Department at the IRB. We've been working on this model for five years now. We have consulted extensively, we have sent out documents for consultations throughout the entire process. What has happened is, in the past, everybody who's came to the counties in South Africa could automatically register as a registered auditor. The reason that this is so is that we have the final exam, which was a public practice exam, and that was generically an audit exam. So from the IRBA's perspective, we were comfortable that all those people going into practice had written this public practice exam, and we were carrying out our mandate to ensure public protection and to ensure that people out there doing the work are competent to do work. When SAICA changed its model about 2009, we had to review our model as well, because SAICA said they're not going to share the public practice exam anymore. They want to have a generic service leader. So chartered accountants were going to change. They weren't going to be specialist chartered accountants anymore. They are going to be business leaders. In that regard, we have to review our own model to say, well, what do we do now? Because we can't rely on a generic business leader exam in case of the assessment of professional competence. And we have to say to ourselves, right now, just go and put another board exam in. Well, quite frankly, then we would have no auditors left, and our mandate would have been severely compromised. So what we did is we went to go and have a look at a lot of international models. We took what we could from the international models, but we also looked locally, and we said, what is it that we can do that is going to be the most seamless process and not going to do exactly what you've outlined to be the challenges, and that would be to make it even a bigger barrier. Also, for looking at our own practices, because it's important that we reflect on what we've done in the past, we realize, you know, in a written explanation is all fine and well, but when you're testing professional competence, the best place to test that is on the job. And so we came up with the audit development program, which has evolved and changed over the years as we've consulted steps that you've got booked with. And this program is really being put in place to say, you know what, we want those people who are passionate about auditing and those people who show the most amount of confidence for auditing. And that means that they get to demonstrate it on the job, not through a written exam. So when we looked at things from transformation perspective, we are quite excited because it means that people who struggle to write exams are not going to struggle to come to our program. Equally, we also see that this is the first time we've got more of a direct relationship with the firm, because as you know, the firms are held to CA charter. So it also means that we get to directly influence transformation within the firms and within the profession, because for a long time it's been an issue for us. But now I think we're going to be in a position where we are able to have more impact with transformation.
I think the other thing that makes us in a much more beneficial position currently is that traditionally, as the RBAs never had to go out in the market and stop RRAs, if I may put it like that. Because when you qualify as a CA, you automatically qualify as an RA if you are in the auditing space. But what that problem also presents as well is an opportunity for us as a body to also get out and reach out to candidates and to also students. So that also means that we also have to take those deliberate steps in terms of transformation. And as many have already indicated as well, the firms on their own are also subscribing to the CA charter. They also have certain transformational goals and things like that. But also very important is that traditionally, if you take it to a good level, kids, if you ask them what they wanted to do, they'll say they want to be a teller accountant. Would never be able to say they want to be an RA. And now God has given us that opportunity to say we have to go out and ensure that those that are still growing up from whatever background they're coming from, they get to also have that dream and that desired opinion and RA. And also very important is that our mandate is public protection, and the exam doesn't really tell us much about any candidate, to put it like that. Yes, the PPE has served us very well, but if we look at that, later at the end of each year in February, get called, because we get candidates that get to pass the exam, but on the job they are very bad. And then we get candidates that are very brilliant on the job, but struggling to go through the exam. And this has given us a beautiful opportunity to say, prove yourself on the job. And honorable, you've also spoken about our control of evidence. That control of evidence is not in any way limiting candidates, because it actually says whatever you've done on the job, collect that and bring that to us as evidence. Most of the candidates, when they are retained post their article, will be retained as junior managers or as supervisors. That's all we are looking for, that you are now acting on a more senior level. So it's not in any way making it difficult. Actually, it makes it much, much easier. And I normally do not like getting to this point, but I qualified as a CA after like 2 years of the auditing profession. I started as a university background as a junior lecturer. And when I went to the auditing firm, I only stayed 2 years. But the current system is also allowing me to be an auditor and open my own firm. And that is not public protection. Public protection should be saying I must be getting experience on a more wider and a senior level, because only at that level do I get to see the factors that come into being when it comes to running your own firm. And post-article, candidates are now starting to be involved in budgeting. They're starting to be involved to be in charge of those trainees that are still doing their first, second, or third year. So they're starting to see different levels of managerial responsibilities. Meaning at the end of the day, the outcome of the auditor that we also have in the next few years will not be just coming from the training program, but will also have managerial experience. And that gives us better public protection, so that's very important for us. And if we look at psychometric tests, even all of those things, we don't do that because we accredited a professional body, and currently we've only accredited PSYCHA, and PSYCHA accredits the university. So we have a monitoring mode to that. So if a candidate enters the university, that is good for us if they study towards being CA currently. So we're not going to be having psychometric tests to see who can be an auditor or not. But for us, that role is looked at through an indirect kind of view through the professional bodies that we've created. So this is really presenting quite different opportunities. And in the last 2 years, we've probably seen more than 1,000 auditors in the last 2 years, and all of them supporting it. And it's quite interesting that when you get partners of auditing firms, they say that they are learning on started after qualifying. And this is exactly what that is giving us as well, that opportunity to develop comes on a more senior level.
I know that that's the school of the main institution that is taking to us. Can you have decisions like students? At first time, the reason is students doesn't even get paid because it's long. So,
we currently have, I think, 16 or 14 universities that are accredited, so it's quite a lot of universities that we use. Yes, they are. And if I just make use of an example, and I will not even mention the name of this university, in 2005, they had a 100% pass rate on their Board 1 study. And that 100% pass rate was only 150 candidates. And then we had a university up in Johannesburg that had an 80% pass rate, but that 80% pass rate equated to more than 200 universities. So we had, not 200 universities, 200 trainees. So we had two universities, one with a 100% pass rate but with just 150, one with an 80% pass rate but with more than 200 trainees. And what that meant was you can get 100% anytime by manipulating numbers, by only pushing trainees or students that are very good and have better chance of passing. But today, if I look at those two universities, they are just equal in terms of numbers. So the game, when it comes to transformation, all universities that come into the game and have come into the pool and are contributing quite a lot as well in that regard. If you look at our numbers as well, so let me make this point. Those numbers that you have there will look a bit skewed, because if you look at those numbers, the RA profession is a much mature kind of a profession. In a huge bank, we need one officer that will bank, but we might need 20 accountants. So that's also something that you need to look at as well, that those numbers must not just be looked at in isolation from those numbers that make up our accounting profession as well. So the question again would be, how do we as the RA encourage people to enter if they've already qualified accountants?
A lot of the questions were around the actual content of the program. So it's been funny, I'm going to try and respond to as many of them as I can. Yeah. Most of those answers were put in the booklet, and at the back of the booklet there's a frequently asked questions section involved that might help you. And just to clarify, I think I have already answered the difference between APC and PPE. The PPE was always focused for the APC is a very, very different exam. And that exam is actually held by the professional body, no longer by the IRBA. So the IRBA board many years ago took the decision to treat the final test of professional competence for auditors. And Pinecore at that stage shared our exam. So when they shifted their exam out, we then moved to the ADP, so it's no longer the PPE, it's now the ADP, these acronyms, it becomes different. And then SAICA has developed its own Part 2 exam, board exam, which is now the APC, the Assessment of Professional Competence. Just to talk about, I think I've answered your question on our consultation. The difficulty of the program, as Ross has alluded to, that has been an issue universities have been wrestling with for many years. And through our presentation model, we actually have a section in transformation and on throughput rates. So we do hold the accredited professional bodies to a standard that says you've got to have proper entry requirements, you've got to have proper support for your candidates, and we would like to see decent throughput rates and, of course, transformation numbers coming out of these programs as well. Is there anything else, Jimmy, I haven't answered? That was put under Master. So Master would take care of all those candidates who have CA in their qualification, and if you can get the qualifications, yeah. It's just the CA in the qualifications, which of course desired as natural progression would include briefs with auditors. Going forward, however, that might be something that as the IRBA we might want to prompt to have a professional body that looks at that in particular.
Krishna Master is really involved in the producing of this book.
So I'm saying the candidate can be allocated without them being seated at one point. Then the implementation is a retrospective or prospective. They've been present online for saying what does it mean. I've been in either retrospective or prospective. And the last point is the redress mechanism for candidates ICE in case of any, it's just the step or the step to oversee the process there. Thank you.
Sorry, I've just lost my train of thought here. Okay, it can start with the last one on disputes. we don't involve the law. So when we are the air perspective, we will not get involved in the labour relations that would happen within the context of the firm. We would support the candidate auditor, but we would rely on the HR policies of the firm, and we do that because all RA firms are held to what we call a standard, an accounting standard, IFQC1. And an IFQC1 is a quality control standard, and that sticks to the HR practices and policies within the context of the firm. We all know it's retrospective, and the PPE is the cover. So all candidates who came through PPE are eligible to register as registered auditors. Those who come through cycle APC will then have to complete the audit development program.
Do you want to follow up, Mr. Okay, there are no more questions. It's about processing as well. I think that what we're going to do tomorrow is late in the morning, as soon as we finish the interface or Anna there will come in there. Probably be sometime late in the morning at 12:30. You can start with the law. We might want to initially think about how you proceed with the law, maybe the three or four policy issues, have a discussion around that, and then start cross by cross. I don't know how. So that means that the team here, Bridget and your team, if you could just look at what we asked in November, what the three or four or five or six key issues here, let's get kind of within the committee members, and then we start looking at close by close. She doesn't say that even we finish the building of the motion, we need some time to model the things, and we look at the sitting. But we cannot have a sitting engaged with the individuals, the experts, you know, the academics, and so on. If the need is identified, but if you don't need a sitting or committee to do that, emails and telephonic exchanges and meetings between, well, we want to come to the committee. So really, unless you mandate me, I can just say, no, one meeting. Hey, here's a meeting, what's the time? The more the merrier. So I don't have to account for any, phases in the world. I say, well, we're all going to involve this. You're getting out of the military here, but I'm pretty sure. That's the procedure of the law, which is, unless we get the idea tomorrow, we're just sorry. Well, as an atheist chef, I enjoy all religious festivals. Although I'm not cooking my stuff, if that's what you need for another task, but that's fine. So right now, what we're going to do is think about that as a process member. Secondly, discuss about policy issues quickly, helped by the Bridget and her team. So you can have the document ready by late tonight. But basically, it was to Alice and ask you involved in that as well. By day 9, if it's completed. It's a short notice, so it's the same issue more or less, but expanded and more refined now, that we did in fact raise in November, and we've now got the ministers later. So the thing should be really preoccupied, other than it because of your background. So I think you should lead because you have a lot of practical experience around some of the issues, and if you can, more carefully than members of parliament will be able to read the ADP, that document. I'm very careful. I said more than members will be able to. Right? And I'm very clear that I'm the principal of the team between 1 and 2. Because they're not something easy. So I've got my program, and that's why I'm going to be at 1. I'm going to finish by 2, because I've got other things in life too, unlike Sandy. Sandy can sit the whole day and a whole night and ignore my children and grandchildren, and she'll be here ready for us at 10 o'clock tomorrow. That's something we may need to. Right. Now, let's quickly go with a 10-minute list. The program for the rest of this term, pending their address, is it for the rest of the term? Let me just change them out. Let's do the first question. Yeah. Colleagues, you reject us several times in your response. Sorry? Hi, I was about to actually, when you said that, I realized there's no need for you to say it. But if you do want to say, I don't know if you're extra friendly, You can stay for another 10 minutes. Okay, so, colleagues, I want to draw your attention to next week's calendar, right? We're going to try, but I think we won't succeed, let's see, whether we can fit next week as planned. That's the 10th. Is that right? That's the 10th. Now, here we have to have a decision soon, because here we need to let a few know. As I understand our discussion, and I don't know others may have other views, but you know, before 2009 was committed to the last Thursday, it will require the minister, and the minister will have a deputy minister to come and give a political overview of what the relevant department, in this case, Trinity, was planning for the year. Then the DG would give an overview of the progress. And then we would have each head of the division tell us briefly program one, something, and then program two, and so on. And then we would reply, we would engage with them, and we will, in the second half, say in the afternoon on this, say, look, these are some things we're thinking about. I think that you rethink these are issues which should also put on the agenda for this calendar year. And then out of that evolves a clear program based in part on evidence that I get. But you have a strategic program. This is a shocking list based on last year and within our last strategic framework. We take a lot of reasons. And we call this what? Understanding the current terrain. And we're going to understand. We're going to engage the terrain and respond to the position. Moving to the second phase of our five-year program. We should also use an opportunity to get a five-year program. The PBO is a really good document set to me. It's an alternative. I mean, I just wanted you to comment on it. So I'll commit you that you can do this in electrical. You can still want to come in on it. I don't know if you pronounce that, but you can do that. But I think the management committee will have to meet next week, one day, beyond. Which is a multi-party structure. So it's DA1, ANC2, and I think all of us one, right? So we will have a formal management meeting next week. I'm preparing for that. I think there's no need for anybody to come. But if you want to come, you will come. We will complete it in the ESCO clock to fail. So I would prefer, though, that do something with the back. We have a meeting. We still prepare for the management meeting next week. But I will, out of that meeting, you know, look at what interesting approach got it, so I mean PBO's got. We try to incorporate that. And I don't think we can mention one day next Saturday, so we will do it in two parts. So we need things to let you know by tomorrow. Because you the thing that I have engaged with Cindy about is the even special circumstance again means we can say the Minister of Finance is probably the only minister, in my opinion, that if he's not available, come next Tuesday, we say we ask him to come. We can understand, because the budget is coming up. So I don't know what we do about that, but the GTA should be here, because he's the county head. So, you know, Cindy, I think people have modeled all of that between now and tomorrow, and I'm hoping that we'll have a fairly good meeting at 1 o'clock tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Is that okay? We have our second for 1 week tomorrow. Good evening. Give us 3 months, so that our position is clear. So, Cindy, at the latest, let you know on Thursday morning. Because remember, we have to make representations, and we don't know how long it takes, then from Thursday to Tuesday, it's like a Thursday week or whatever. Okay? So, Tuesday the 10th, May following, but hopefully it won't. Wednesday the 11th. Sorry? Yeah, but we, the idea would be that we carry on with the number. We also have to follow it. Then during the other problem might be then to move to Tuesday the 17th, we break up the strategic planning session in two halves or something, or find a Friday to have it. So we'll discuss that with members. Can you apply your mind to all of that? And then the rest of the program is as it is. The outstanding matter, now, colleagues, is that We got an email, all of us did yesterday from Forest Economy. And let me read to you quickly because I might have collected a decision on this. Essentially, it's a request. All of you will have got this at the same time, sent it to 25 people. I don't need 25. You can find it on the email. Basically, you say that we had agreed last year. So let me read to you again. Dear Chairperson Karim and members of the Standing Committee of Science, in 2014, the Standing Committee resolved that we should prepare a presentation and input on pump-share pricing and present to the committee for consideration. We have done so and sought expert advice and comments on the document perspective that we developed. May we please be granted an opportunity within the proposed program to make the presentation to the committee. The presentation and discussions might be helpful in light of the high-level panel on innovative financial goals which presented to the CRA to the 20 professionals of the AEU in Addis Ababa this past week, and please advise on how we proceed to government. That is what it's all about. Now, before I hand over to you to respond to the effect, as I remember, I don't know how. So, Mr. Shivan, we're constantly raising this issue. We said, how do we agree to address this issue? And he kept repeating the same platitude. So we said, go there, what is that you think? And he didn't get much of that. Then he explained that there are two cities, well, three cities, on the matter that, look, the other thing is getting a discussion agreement, he's making it for the two pages. Neither of those locations, the one in the hotel up there, or the specific sitting we had with them, Mineral and Energy. Was the Shibabu there? I think the Mineral and Energy sitting, they had one member of the effect on the NGOs. And we know that there's no somebody. We're given a thing. So in fact, that's all of the way. Now, if you look at our program, and you look at the decisions we've taken, we've asked the PBO to actually to work on this matter. And they're going to report with it. We gave them the terms of reference, we sent two letters, there's no comment from anybody. But it's here somewhere later, I think, in the end of the first quarter. So that's where we are. So what is the response of members to the report? Can I just include it in the program as it is? Because we, if we have a space, we will accommodate it. But simply speaking, we've gone further than, last year. We've had a whole sitting on this matter with Eldos, and we've subsequently written to trade and industry, all the committee team, I've forgotten now, but I've written to all of them. They came back to us, some of them have said, go ahead. So I think we should put it into that process. But it's always part of that process. Would that not be a reasonable answer? Let me respond to that. First, I shall write back to say, there are no problems, but it should be sent into the process. Okay, thank you. Good over. Bye.